Good afternoon. My name is Deborah Freeman, and on behalf of LaRouche PAC, I'd like to welcome all of you to today's historic presentation. As I think most of our listeners know, Mr. LaRouche will be giving a live broadcast from Washington, D.C., just 2 days after Barack Obama takes the oath of office. That broadcast on January 22nd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time will be before a live audience. But the demand for Mr. LaRouche to address the nation and to address the world prior to President Obama's inauguration, in the midst of what is inarguably the worst crisis that our nation has ever faced, was overwhelming. And in meeting that demand, we scheduled today's webcast. We have questions that have already come in from our nation's capital, from Moscow, and indeed from all over the world. We will continue to field questions as today's historic broadcast proceeds. Without any further introduction, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to present to you Mr. Lyndon LaRouche.
To begin with, before getting into the questions and my response to them, I would remark that I'm focused at this point in my direct remarks here on the situation posed by the appearance of Paul Volcker in the committee, the 30 group, which recently met. And the significance of that is this: no one knows exactly what President Obama is going to conclude on the issue of the international monetary financial crisis. I haven't talked with him, and he has, of course, has restrained himself on a number of matters pending the time that he is the actual president, as opposed to speaking as a president-elect. So my concern is to try to clarify exactly what President Obama must consider in making crucial decisions which bear upon international relations, particularly those affecting the world economy. Now, the problem here is that, as you most of you know, the president has not spoken on the actual crucial issues of world economy, nor has anyone else, really. A few people here that are neon in the world have talked about it, but before the public, there has been no competent discussion of the most crucial issues which threaten and face the world today. And I'm certain from the performance of the people in the U.S. Congress that virtually none of them is competent in any degree to deal with this. You will recall that on the 25th of July in 2007, I forecast the imminent collapse, the breakdown of the international monetary financial system as an oncoming process. 3 days after that, the breakdown occurred. Idiots and liars, variously, referred to that as a special kind of subprime mortgage crisis. It was not. What happened in particular, which bears exactly what I have to say to you right now today, is that what I was forecasting was not a mortgage crisis, but something quite different. I was calling attention to the fact that the world has been destroyed in terms of world economy by a growth of what are called financial derivatives. This plague of financial derivatives took off shortly after Mr. Volcker's leaving office under the direction of his successor, Alan Greenspan. And Alan Greenspan did something which no decent man should have done, which was to create the financial derivatives bubble which dominates the world today. Now, what I was forecasting on the 25th of July was a breakdown of the international financial derivatives bubble, a bubble which is in the order of magnitude equivalent to, nominally, about $1.4 quadrillion. And this bubble is still growing implicitly until we put it to sleep and get rid of it. Now, what we have to do, we are never going to bail out $1.4 quadrillion worth of inflating claims against the world economy. We are going to have to wipe out most of the financial claims from the books. We're going to put the world, which we have to save, a physical world, we're going to put the world into protection. And we're going to put it into protection by eliminating the greatest part of the nominal financial claims held by financial institutions of the world today. If you don't do that, which is what most people are afraid to even talk about, if you don't do that, if you don't wipe most of the things that have been subject to bailout from the books, you cannot save the world physical economy from a general breakdown, which would mean that the world's population would probably sink from about 6.5 billion people today to about 1 billion or less within a matter of a generation or two. So therefore, if you have any care for humanity, you're going to wipe financial derivatives off the books. What I'd warned about in July 25th of 2007 is that the rate of increase, of self-increase, of hyperinflationary increase of these financial derivatives was growing at such a rate relative to a physically collapsing economy that the thing was going to break at the weakest point in the system. Now, what happened because of Alan Greenspan's playing with Fannie Mae, and you should never play with your Fannie, but because of that, we'd reached a point where the subprime mortgage factor had become the reflection, the leading reflection of the breakdown of the international financial derivative system. So what I was forecasting was not a spill-off from a breakdown of one sector of the mortgage sector into the world economy, but the world economy's collapse causing symptomatically a breakdown of the subprime mortgage sector, which is the most corrupt and weakest part of the whole mortgage system, which Alan Greenspan had used as one of his drivers for his role, together with the City of London, in creating this hyperinflationary crisis. What is happening is that the rate of self-growth of the financial derivatives bubble has reached the point relative to a collapsing physical level of productivity per capita per square kilometer, which is topping the whole system. The secondary factor in this was the fact that the United States economy, since 1968, the U.S. economy has, physical economy has been collapsing in physical terms, per capita and per square kilometer. And as since, especially since 1989, the European economy has also been collapsing as the former Soviet Union's economy was collapsing. So what we have is a process of a collapse of the physically productive economies of the United States, particularly in Europe in particular, and the former Soviet Union. At the same time that we have been exporting production to cheap labor markets in places such as China and elsewhere. China is a particularly crucial case because China has become dependent upon largely doing the production for the United States and in part Europe. China's the most extreme case. India, for example, has a lower ratio of its total economy depends upon exports. China has a great part of its present economy depends upon this export market. So therefore, as this market collapses, financial market collapses, then inevitably China collapses. Russia is collapsing for similar related reasons. The economies of Western and Central Europe are collapsing. The economies of Eastern Europe, probably formerly part of the Soviet system, or the extended Soviet system, actually have been living under worse physical conditions, not maybe political conditions somewhat improved, but political physical conditions than they were under the Soviet system. Poland is worse off today than it was under Soviet domination under the Comecon, for example. So what you have is a breakdown of what was formerly the agro-industrial powerhouses of the world including the United States, which have become more and more post-industrial societies, falling to lower and lower levels of technology per capita. While on the other hand, we have been going into cheap labor markets, where we underpay the actual costs of production, as in China and elsewhere, which is in the so-called globalized world. So therefore, we've been operating under an insane trend since 1967-68. Which is the last time that the United States was operating physically at a net rate of growth physically. And since that time, as typified by the breakdown in the U.S. basic economic infrastructure, the United States economy has been disintegrating. The level of productivity, the level of scientific progress have all been collapsing in terms of production. Europe since 1989, since 1990 in particular, Europe has been collapsing. We have been expanding the markets for production for a while in China and elsewhere, the so-called third world or related kinds of economies. Now, the whole shebang, which was based on hyperinflationary investment and speculation, has now come into a chain reaction collapse. There's nothing you can do in terms of reforming the present system to prevent the entire planet from going into a dark age. You can get out of this mess, very simply. Go back to our Constitution and go back to the thinking of Franklin Roosevelt as of 1944. We go to that kind of thinking and put the world through bankruptcy reorganization and change away from this monetary system we have, which you cannot save. You cannot save the world monetary system. You cannot save the world banking system in its present form. It's impossible. What you can do is you can save the physical economy and return to the principles of the U.S. Constitution, as best understood in the early days by Alexander Hamilton, and go to a credit system based on the U.S. principle of credit system rather than international monetary system. Now, to do this will require another step. The basic problem of the world today is what some people call the British Empire. But British Empire is sometimes a misleading term, because it is certainly not, if you look at the faces of Britons, it is certainly not the empire of the mind of the British people. What you're looking at is an international speculative banker control of the international monetary financial system. Now, this empire, through globalization, extends all over the world, and it is a world empire. You can call it a Anglo-Dutch-Saudi empire, especially since 1973, when that great oil swindle was pulled off, and we've been living under it ever since. But this is the empire. It's like all great empires in European history. They have not been really national empires or empires of nations. They've been empires of financial interests, usurious financial interests. And what's running the world today is a usury-ridden financier system, which is now breaking down. The world, the planet, will no longer tolerate this system. And if we try to support the system, the world will no longer tolerate us. That's the problem. So therefore, the United States must, because only the United States can do this, through our Constitution and our tradition, we can do it. We put the world monetary financial system into bankruptcy reorganization, which means that some things that are essential will continue to be paid. They'll be honored. Our investment in these things will expand. Other things, which people have been using as substitutes for production in this kind of crazy market, are going to be frozen, just as you do in any attempt to salvage an economy which is financially bankrupt. So we're putting the entire world system through bankruptcy reorganization. Doing that will, in effect, will eliminate the present world empire, the Anglo-Dutch-Saudi empire. That is the banker, the financier empire. What it was required, therefore, is that the United States, under this next president, has no sane choice. None. It's not a matter of what you like and what you don't like. Do you like to survive? Do you wish the United States to continue to survive? Do you wish European civilization to come back? Do you wish to save China from chaos and possible breakup? Do you wish to stabilize and protect India? Do you wish to save Russia and what it represents in its key role in the world? Do you want a partnership among these forces who, in their common interest as separately sovereign states, agree to unite against the forces of empire and say, bankers who have swindled, financiers who have swindled, or have engaged in wild speculation, who've now driven the world physical economy to the point of breakdown, these people are going to eat it. We're going to put the world through bankruptcy reorganization and take the viable part of the world and bring great nations together, together with relatively weaker nations, and bring a world system of the type envisaged by Franklin Roosevelt in 1944. And we're going to create that system of cooperation among nation states, end all traces of imperialism, end all globalization, and go back to the sovereign nation state and its people. And do it on the basis of the famous principle of 1648, the Westphalian principle. A group of nations, each of which is dedicated primarily to the interests of the group of nations as a whole. And we're going to build the kind of world that Franklin Roosevelt had intended in 1944 at Bretton Woods. We use the model of the US credit system, the Hamiltonian conception of a credit system, an introduction of national banking as a policy, as Hamilton prescribed this, and use this in cooperation with other nations to create a sufficient combination of power to force through the needed bankruptcy reorganization of the world. If you don't like that, I'm sorry. You either do it or you're not going to survive. This is not one of those cases where it's a matter of your choice, your tastes, your prejudices, your traditions in the ordinary sense. Do you wish this nation to survive? Do you wish this planet to survive? Are you willing to step forward, as in the case of incoming President Obama? Is he prepared to step forward to make an unprecedented decision, putting the entire world into bankruptcy reorganization, putting the most powerful financial interests of the world into receivership in bankruptcy reorganization, shut down the whole derivatives market, freeze it, save everything that is essential in terms of infrastructure development, in terms of production, in terms of physical standard of living, and bring together a coalition of nations which, as a combined power of sovereign states, have the power to take the British Empire or similar empires and tell them, you guys are in receivership. You can live, but you're going to live in receivership. And break this present monetary system, which has dominated us especially since about 1968. We've got to do that if we wish to survive. Now, there are many problems involved in this. What I've said is true. There is no sane alternative existing on this planet to what I have just said. I don't care what your degrees are, what your opinions are. This is reality. This is not choice. This is reality. This is like the position of a person in command in warfare. And the President of the United States, the incoming president, faces the challenge that the greatest military commanders and leaders of nations have faced in general warfare. This kind of responsibility to act for mankind with everything that's in you to act that way. We do it or we don't survive. And the President of the United States has to be presented with that fact. We do it this way or we don't survive. Don't talk about other people's suggestions. They have failed. The leading institutions of education and professions relevant to this problem have all failed. They have failed for over 40 years, and actually much longer. Either we change our ways, reject those traditions of 40 years, and go back to the United States as conceived by the founders and is affirmed by President Franklin Roosevelt, or we are not going to survive. Do you wish to survive? That's the question. Not is your opinion going to be honored, but is your opinion worth honoring? Does it correspond to the requirement of survival? We are now at that point. We're at the point where the inauguration of the next president of the United States this coming Tuesday will largely answer the question, is this nation going to survive? Is civilization globally going to survive? Do we have a president with the backing needed to make the kind of decisions from the United States which will enable this planet to survive and outlive the greatest financial collapse ever imagined globally? Now that involves some other questions, because what this signifies is that our culture has been wrong. Our educational systems have failed. Our popular opinion has been a tragic mistake. Most of the things that people have taken for granted and assumed were wrong, because if they had not been wrong, we wouldn't be in this mess. When the Titanic is sinking, don't negotiate for a better stateroom. That's not your job. Get off the ship. And this is the challenge we face today. Now, what are the problems? First of all, we haven't failed to understand completely the basic principle of physical economy. Don't talk about money economy. Yes, money is significant. Managing money, organizing it, this is very important. But what's your principle of economy? I mean, physical economy. I'm talking about per square kilometer of territory. I'm talking about per capita. I'm talking about longevity of household members of households. These kinds of things. How do we produce? For example, let's take the case of India. India is an interesting country. About 63% of the population is extremely poor. They mostly have an agricultural base, and that base is shrinking. For example, a water crisis. India does not have, presently, a secure supply of potable water for agriculture and human life, because we've been drawing down there, as in many other parts of the world, we've been drawing down on fossil water resources, and we've been draining them. Now we're going to have to go to large-scale desalination to produce clean water in necessary quantities, which means we're going to a global nuclear physical economy, especially nuclear power. This will mean uranium fission. It will mean also thorium fission. Now, in both cases, you use a thing called plutonium to charge a uranium reactor or to charge a thorium reactor. You have to do that. This means that we take this plutonium, which we have, which has been tanked up as a military resource, and we make it available for its function in charging nuclear reactors, using not only uranium, but the thorium cycle. India is a perfect example. India is a nation which has, like Australia, a fairly large portion of the world's available thorium resources. Therefore, if we wish to save the population along the coasts of southern India from this kind of threat there, we have to charge up thorium reactors, and the Indians are prepared to produce these reactors, charge them up, and use these as a way of increasing the potential productivity of a population which does not have inherently present skills needed for the population of that nation, for the 63% of the lower income brackets of that nation. So it has a right, that nation has a right, other nations have a right to have the thorium cycle as well as the uranium cycle fully utilized, like fourth generation nuclear reactors, utilized to ensure that we're able to deal with such a simple thing as the water, fresh water resources, which humanity requires. So we have to junk all this anti-nuclear nonsense. We have to go to higher technology. Some people think that you can count energy in calories. You're an idiot. You don't measure energy, you measure power. And it's the energy flux density cross-section of the power source which determines the potential productivity of that application of energy to production. Therefore, we have to go to high density nuclear power sources if we're going to develop the kind of sources required to take a population now of over 6.5 billion people, rising towards 7, and even to provide the fresh water and other elements required to sustain these populations of the world. If you're not willing to take on the world, you're creating a situation of warfare and conflict. Therefore, you have to act in the common interest of mankind, but through assembling the independent sovereign nations of mankind in their common interest, in the same sense that the 1648 Peace of Westphalia got Europe out of over a century of religious warfare in Europe. We have to come to an understanding. Therefore, for example, in this case alone, we have to take Russia, which is a Eurasian nation, that is, it has a combination of European history and an Asian cultural component, which is largely dominant in the northern part of the Eurasian continent. We take China, with 1.4 billion people estimated as its current population, which is now threatened with a crisis beyond your imagination, unless we fix it. We take India, which is 1.1 billion people. You take the other relatively smaller but largely populated nations of Asia. Then you look at Africa. We get the British out of Africa. The British are perpetrating genocide in Africa, they and their accomplices. Get them out of Africa. Give Africa back to the Africans. Repeal decisions made by the United States in the middle of the 1970s. Restore Africa to its right as a collection of sovereign states, which means we must assist them in developing the infrastructure which is needed to take a population in Africa which is largely unskilled in the modern sense, and to utilize infrastructure and other features to increase the productive powers of labor effectively per capita per square kilometer. Africa has a great agricultural potential, but disease and other factors destroy that. The lack of infrastructure means that the utilization of improvements needed to realize that. Africa has large resources or natural resources. Enable Africa to use its territory, its agricultural potential, and its related resources to become a positive factor in world economy. The world needs it. Africa is one of the major sources of raw materials required for humanity, as is South America, as is in Asia, as particularly in northern Russia. These resources must be mobilized through high technology to, in many cases, take populations which are poor in skills, but committed to productivity, and by use of infrastructural features, such as mass transportation systems, especially magnetic levitation, by high-density power sources, by large-scale water management, and so forth, and use these as factors to increase the effective productivity of people who, under present conditions, are not too productive. And that's the way we can solve the problem. This means, again, as was often said during the earlier times, earlier decades, we speak of the common aims of mankind. We think, as Roosevelt did, Franklin Roosevelt, about building a world free of empire, a world of sovereign nation states which are united in common cause by the Westphalian principle, and build a world of no empire, but a world of sovereign nation states, and bring forth what our greatest resources. And those resources are cultural resources, the resources of people who came from Europe into North America to create a nation free of the worst political diseases and social diseases of Europe. And we succeeded to a large degree. We were corrupted by European influences, but we, at the same time, we represented a kind of nation state which does not exist in any other part of the world. We've betrayed that in a large degree. We must return to that. And as I say specifically, we must, beginning on Monday, Tuesday, we must hope that the President of the United States will emerge as committed to the kind of perspective I've indicated here, and will reach out to nations in particular such as Russia, China and India, China and Russia have immediate crisis problems. India has a longer term crisis problem of one kind, but also threats of instability coming out of Southwest Asia today. We must bring these nations together, representing a great part of the world population, and use that unity of cooperation, of Westphalian cooperation, among these four powers and others, to break the power of empire, which we must destroy if we're going to finish off this financial system which is killing us now. We just have to change our ways in that sense. We have to have a president who has the courage, and that president must be defended and supported as if he were Franklin Roosevelt. We have to go back to what Roosevelt had intended before he died. We have to rip up the corruption which Harry Truman and others introduced to betray us and to betray our great mission, which we had going into World War II, and get back to fulfilling that obligation. Now, that means we've got to change the way we talk about economics. We've got to stop talking about money as such and realize that money is merely a means of exchange. We must regulate it. We must regulate banking. We must go back to the kind of banking we had under Glass-Steagall. We must get back to that. We must separate the banking in which you put your money, if you have it, for deposit, which the local community depends upon for its lending practice and so forth. We must put this section of banking back into business as chartered banking under the kinds of protectionism which Roosevelt, for example, exemplified. We must take the other part of banking, the high-risk part, separate it, look at the garbage, and put the garbage through cancellation. Financial derivatives don't contribute anything to a world economy. It's gambling debts. And the policy of the US government was, we don't pay gambling debts. If you lost, you lost. You gambled and you lost. But we must protect those banks, those state and local banks, and local banks, which are chartered banks, which are banks of deposit, which are the reference point for investment. We must provide the credit generated by a federal credit system to ensure that those banks, which are now mostly bankrupt as a result of recent policies, especially the policies of the US Congress under George W. Bush since the summer of 2007, those banks have been bankrupted, but we must save the chartered bank element within those banks, restore it. We must freeze claims of other kinds and probably cancel them because they're simply gambling debts. And we are not obliged as a nation to pay other people's gambling debts. Let them go bankrupt. We then, in turn, having canceled these claims against the economy, must create a new flow of credit under our Constitution. And that flow of credit must ensure that the local chartered bank and the local national bank are able to perform their traditional function in cooperation with government for creating a system of long-term credit to generate the rebuilding of our economy. Agriculture, industry, infrastructure. We have a population which has largely lost skills. People who have not worked at skilled labor over the past 40 years nearly certainly are not very productive. They know how to push a pencil, they know how to play with a computer and play with other things, but they don't know how to produce in the way we used to produce. Therefore, we have a largely unskilled population with a shrunken section of the machine tool sector scales, and we have to amplify the productivity of an unskilled population, which is what most of our population is in terms of production. We have to amplify their productivity by increasing the infrastructure which affects our productivity. We must concentrate on high energy flux density power sources, which means nuclear power largely. We must go to mass transportation, forget the automobile as a mass transit unit. Automobiles are for local transportation. High-speed rail and the similar kinds of transport are the way to go. We overuse air travel. for relatively short-term travel. Air travel is strictly for long-term. We can produce now, we can produce systems of over 300 miles an hour. Efficient systems for mass transportation. We're using too much aircraft travel. We're using too many cars on the street. Too many cars on the highway. We should have efficient mass transit systems of various kinds where people can be transported. For example, I've spoken before. You have outside of Washington, you have an area around Washington, D.C. It's a market area. You look at it as a market area. It's an area from which people come as far as 2.5 to 3 hours each way commuting into the Washington area or that approach. Now, just think of what that means. Suppose we're talking about 3 hours. That's 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. Now, what does that mean? If you're taking a person who's working 8 hours a day and not being paid for lunchtime and things like that, and now has 5 to 6 hours a day that's spent on commuting time, what kind of a family life do they have? What kind of a society do you have? We need efficient, high-speed mass transit systems. We need to go back to much more distribution of production away from a few large centers of mass industry into regional development. Smaller industries, more emphasis on closely held corporations, on smaller high-tech corporations and industries. We need to rebuild the idea of a community where you can walk to work in a quarter an hour or half an hour each way, at most each day, which is what we used to have years ago. That's the way we organized. And leave these extra hours we're now wasting on sitting in a useless car, smelling up the gas from the other guy's pipe, and getting sick and having no family life, and leaving children, if you have any, at home without much cultural backing and development. We're crazy. So we have to go now to a shift toward long-term investment in high technology, mass transit systems, power systems, water systems. Remember the time you could safely take a drink of water from a faucet? In an average home, in an average community? Can you do that now? We have to reverse those trends which have led to that effect. We have to go into long-term investment. We're talking about 25-year investment for industries. We're talking about for power systems and things like that, you're talking about 50-year investments. For larger systems, you're talking about 100-year investments. We in the United States and other nations must cooperate with our credit systems to assure that the technology is mobilized and that the credit is created, low-cost credit is created to fund these changes for the better. Back for the case of the United States, to what we used to think, back while Kennedy was still alive, President Kennedy, and back to those standards which most of us accepted in this country then. And that's all we have to do, is go back to the kind of mentality which built the space program, which we can't do that the way anymore. When did we last put a man on the moon? We lost the capability to do that. We have to invest again with a mission orientation, which is multi-generational, 25, 50, 100 years. And we have to mobilize the credit at low interest rate and commitment to improvements in technology to do that. We have to enter into cooperation with nations such as China, Russia, and India, and other nations as a bloc to create the kind of world that Franklin Roosevelt envisaged before he died. To rebuild a world free of imperialism, and he meant British imperialism, free of imperialism, which is what our destiny was and our commitment was among many of us going into what became known as World War II. We have to think that way. We have to have leaders who will think that way and will talk that way. We need, above all, a president who will think that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Len. In addressing the questions that have come in. Let me say that I will take some liberties because we have many questions that address the same issue. We also have questions that are more specific in nature on issues that Mr. LaRouche did address in the course of his remarks, but obviously some of our listeners require clarification, and obviously these are extremely difficult issues to be taken up. From the US side, most of the institutional questions that we have come from people who are involved in the transition to a new administration. We also have a significant number of questions from Capitol Hill, and in something which is a bit different from some of our previous broadcasts, we also have a number of questions that have come in from Russia, from Ukraine, from Belarus, which I will entertain during the course of today's proceedings. I'm going to try as much as possible to group the questions according to certain broad categories. And I am going to begin with some very broad general questions before I move to some of the more detailed and specific ones. Lynn, the first question is one that has actually been posed in a variety of forms, both by people here in Washington who are part of the American side of DC's institutions, but it's also a question that has been posed repeatedly by some of our friends in the diplomatic corps, and as we moved into today's event, it's a question that has been posed by several people who submitted questions from around the world. What they are basically saying is they say, Mr. LaRouche, when you talk about new international arrangements, and most specifically your four-nation agreement, you've talked repeatedly about considering India and China as participants in that agreement, obviously for many reasons, but also principally including the fact that these are nations that have populations in excess of a billion people. My question to you is this: why do you not consider a 1.2 billion population, which serves as the majority population in more than 56 countries and as a minority population in many others? Obviously, what I am talking about are the number of people in the world today who are followers of the Muslim faith. It seems to me that it is essential for America and other world leaders to begin to consider this problem, to know Islam, to know its ideology, and to try to cope with them rather than controlling or invading or challenging them. I understand fully that the so-called Islamic countries are each individually sovereign nations, and that they are quite different in their goals, in their plans, in their leaders, in their economies, and so forth. But it is also the case that the overall system of Islamic rules and ideology is somewhat unique. And it seems that in crafting any system, there has to be some way to take this into account, even though I'm well aware of the fact that there is no sovereign nation called Islam. Do you see this as a problem? Have you thought about it? And how do you propose that we begin to address it as we think about crafting a new financial architecture?
Well, the idea of an Islamic factor politically in national agreements does not work. As you see right now, for example, the country with the largest Islamic population is India, not Pakistan. India. You have a Pakistan is dismembered itself. Well, let's get to the dirty word here. The dirty word is empire. And if you go back to the Lord Shelburne, who was the author of the British Empire in the form, functional form, of a private company called the British East India Company, which was actually an imperial power in its own right, with its own armies, its own means, and so forth. And the British Empire was never really the British people. The British Empire was defined under Shelburne as a model of empire based on the Roman Empire. And he referred to specifically, what was referred to was what? Julian the Apostate. The Emperor Julian the Apostate is the British model. How did the British model work? Now, the British have created empires, imperial wars on this planet. For example, the Seven Years' War was the war that created the British Empire. The British crew, which was a financial group, not the British people, but the British group, Anglo-Dutch liberal group, organized a war among the nations of Europe, a mutual war. The depletion of Europe in 7 years of this nuclear war produced a Peace of Paris under which a British empire was formed as a private company under the leadership of Lord Shelburne. The British empire organized Napoleon Bonaparte. Napoleon Bonaparte was an asset of the British. Whether he knew it or not is another question. But the Napoleonic Wars, which were wars on the continent of Europe, ruined Europe to such a degree that Europe has never fully recovered from that since. Europe is still under an empire. It's an empire of international financier interest, sometimes called the British Monetary System or the European Monetary System, which is an empire. Now, how does it work? Julian the Apostate's method. Go back to the Roman Empire or even earlier empires. How do they work? They work by organizing people around religious and related conflicts, cultural conflicts. For example, take the whole question of West Asia. What's going on there now? Well, it's an imperial operation. Who runs it? It's an Anglo-Dutch-Saudi financial group that runs that warfare. What's that called? It's called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The entirety of the war in Southwest Asia, including what is going on in Gaza today, including what's going on against India in a fragmented nation called Pakistan in Central Asia today, what is it? It's the British Empire, and which takes every part, every religious group, and defies it. You've got the Wahhabite section, which became more significant during the period of George Bush the First, back in 1979. We organized this war in Afghanistan as a lure under Brzezinski to get the Soviets trapped into a war in Afghanistan, which would be comparable to the folly we were subjected to by getting us through a lie into a war in Indochina. You look at the history, World War I. How was it organized? It was organized by the King of England, when he was still a prince. How'd they do it? Well, they got rid of Bismarck. Bismarck was determined to prevent another 7 years' war in Europe and made agreement with the Russian Tsar and others to sabotage any effort to get Germany in support of Austria in a Balkan war. So what did the British Empire do? They got rid of him. And he recognized it. Why? He said their effort was to start a new 7 years' war and more. What is that? That's what became known as World War I. That's what became known as World War II. That's what became known as the crisis in Southwest Asia today. That's what they do in Africa. That's what they do in South America. You have one of the world's worst drug pushers, a guy trained by the Nazis to be what he comes today, George Soros, who's the biggest drug pusher in the world. Mexico is threatened. The United States is threatened because of George Soros and his operations in Mexico. George Soros is a big organizer of drug traffic throughout the Western Hemisphere. You want to clean up the Western Hemisphere? You want security in the Western Hemisphere, in South and Central America, in the United States? Get rid of George Soros. And get rid of what he influenced, what he represents. Who does he work for? He works for the British Commonwealth. He's a British agent. Pulling the same kind of thing. What do you think happened in Gaza? Why should anyone go to a war in Gaza, this type? Why should the Israelis do it? Because they're manipulated by the British entirely. And Cheney. And Cheney, who is essentially more British agent than anything else. He and his wife. And they set this operation up, which is intended to ruin the possibility of U.S. stability under the incoming President Obama. And Soros is a part of that. What's the problem in Ukraine? George Soros. George Soros, with the help of Cheney, ran the operation, which is the problem in Ukraine today. So, in Islam, the same thing. What do you think the population of India is? There are more Muslims in India than there are in Pakistan. You want to have unified? You cannot unify Islam as long as the British Empire exists. The Saudis run a different operation, contrary to the interests of others. Our view is we respond to one kind of institution. The institution is the sovereign nation state. And a nation which is unwilling to be a sovereign nation state and to organize upon some other basis than that of the sovereign nation state and the principles of the rights of the human individual on this planet through their sovereign nation state. Anyone who tries that is sending the world to hell. So it may sound nice. Can't we get all Islam together to agree? You can never get Islam together. You'll never get it together. Not as long as the British Empire has its influence there. For example, you had a terrorist operation which was run in Mumbai. It used to be known as Mumbai. It was done while I was there in India recently. Where did it come from? From London. London ran that operation, not Pakistan. Yes, there were people in ISI, MI6's ISI, who were key in that. But there were Britain. Who was running? Who was protecting these guys in London who were running terrorism in Mumbai? And by the way, this is the most serious terrorist threat the world has known yet. Because what was done in Mumbai, that organization represents a repeatable phenomenon. You know, 9/11 was the same kind of thing. It was the same kind of operation initially, but it was a one-time operation. What was done in Mumbai was not a one-time operation. It's a many-time operation. Small terrorist operations which destabilize countries. Now, where did it come from? The center of this was inside the Church of England. And you had people who were part of the Wahhabite influence in the Muslim community in England, who were part of the extension of this international terrorist operation. It's well known, all the documentation is there. Anybody who knows the region knows it. This is not a mystery. Somebody tells you it's not true, tell them, well, go back and get your education, but you're not qualified for intelligence. And so this, the Archbishop of Canterbury is protecting agents inside the Muslim community in England, and most of these Muslim community in England are perfectly decent people. But you've got a few real wild animals. They are controlled by the Wahhabite Center in Saudi Arabia. And they're British agents. They operate through Dubai, which is the center of international drug trafficking and gold and so forth and other kinds of trades in the world. And that's how the thing is controlled. Before you can deal with a nation state or deal with any group of people as a nation, they must have a certain kind of coherence, that of a nation. And the Muslim population of the world today is not a nation. And the British play game with it. And they say, Well, look, for example, how did it happen? Take the case in Gaza. How did it happen? Well, the Gaza operation was planned by Dick Cheney and the British in January of 2008. And it was kept on ice for the post-November 2008 year, election year. It was supposed to be come off between the time of the election and the inauguration of the current President of the United States, President-elect. So now, what happened? You have a factor inside there, inside the Muslim population of the world, which is called the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, just as Sykes-Picot, the entire politics of the Middle East, is all controlled by London under the Sykes-Picot arrangements. One feature of the Sykes-Picot is the Muslim Brotherhood, which of course has many different characteristics in different places it operates, especially in Egypt. But the Gaza Strip, the Hamas, essentially was controlled top-down by the Muslim Brotherhood. So what happened is they agreed on two British assets. One, the Muslim Brotherhood, it's a British asset, and the other side, you had the other British asset, the Israeli government. And the two of them, under a Sykes-Picot agreement, decided they're going to have a war with each other. Not because the people of the Gaza Strip wanted, but because the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood wants it. So you get a Saudi operation, which involves an intercepting an acquisition of Iranian missiles. Somebody takes these missiles, which are taken away from the Iranian source, and they use a couple of these missiles and fire them into Gaza Strip, and say it is a part of Cheney's effort to get a war attack going on Iran before the inauguration of the current of the next president. This is the kind of problem we face. If there is no agreement in principle, that is in the principle of relations among nation states, sovereign nation states, then it's not, you can negotiate with it, you can deal with it as a phenomenon, you can respect the rights of people, but you cannot allow the creation of blocks of types which are controlled by an empire such as the British Empire. And when people talk about bringing Islam together today, what they're talking about is turning it over. Islam is a force controlled by the British Empire. You're talking about a return to the pantheonic principle of Julian the Apostate. And that's poison. I don't care how much I love the Islamic peoples. I'm not going to endorse their taking poison.
Okay, Lynn, the next question. And this is from one section of the transition group. Say, Mr. LaRouche, this may seem to be the most basic and general question, but I think that you understand that we have spent countless hours debating it. When you talk about a new Bretton Woods, and you did it again today, you said that you are talking about a credit system, not a monetary system. And this is causing tremendous problems in conceptualizing exactly how to bring such a new system together. Is it necessary from your standpoint that we create two completely separate agreements? On the one hand, a new financial architecture with agreements tied to it as to how each nation will value its money and everything that's attached to that. And then, as well, an international credit arrangement that would be directed toward multinational approaches to great projects, etc. We are having tremendous difficulty conceptualizing how to bring the two together. They seem to be completely separate entities requiring completely separate agreements.
Well, I agree, you cannot bring the two together. You shouldn't try. You should cancel the monetary system. You have to cancel the monetary system. Now, first of all, if you're a patriot of the United States, you have to do it that way. You may be a misguided patriot, but if you're not a misguided patriot and you think you're a patriot, you're really, really not on the right course. Look, what's common about the U.S. Constitution involved here? You're talking about two things, agreements among nations and the credit system. Look at the Constitution. There is no difference. If you adopt the U.S. Constitution in terms of a credit system, and it is our law, anytime we're operating not under a credit system, we are violating our law. What is that law? The President of the United States, or the Office of the President of the United States, prompts the Congress, through the House of Representatives, to authorize an utterance of credit, monetizable credit. Huh? On the basis of the monetization of that credit, or the potential monetization of that credit system, operating under the rules of agreement which the executive has struck with the Congress on this utterance, you now issue credit. There is no money or no monetary aggregate which can be issued and uttered in the United States which is not done under that constitutional arrangement. We do not allow a monetary system. Now, then you talk about relations with other states. Let's go, how do we greet a treaty with other nations? The same procedure. The executive branch, or at least in responsibility, initiates a suggestion that it wants to do something, or the Congress induces it to say it wants it, to create a treaty agreement with other nations. Yeah? On the basis of the Congress's accepting that treaty, whatever comes out of the negotiation, the United States now has a treaty relationship with another nation. So the question of treaty relationship with the other nation and a credit system are identical. What is wrong is entering into monetary agreements with other nations outside the credit system, outside our constitutional system. There's no need for it. We shouldn't do it. It's a violation of our Constitution. Admittedly, we have British influences in the United States who believe in a monetary system. What's a monetary system? A monetary system is a private organization of international bankers and similar kinds of scoundrels, which forces a government to make an agreement with it, like the old British system under the Church of Bank of England. But the currency, the utterance of the currency, the monetary aggregate, is not created constitutionally. It's created by a private organization which enters into agreement with nation states to submit to its sodomy. Monetary sodomy is what you call it. Now, I'm for the repeal of monetary sodomy, especially among nations and especially involving the United States. We are going to cancel, if we have any brains, we're going to cancel the existing world monetary system. We're not going to negotiate with it. We'll negotiate with nations, but not with a monetary system, because we are going to cancel most of the monetary aggregate, especially that which is tied in with this big and hyperinflated mass of $1.4 quadrillion estimated value in financial derivatives. We're going to cancel it. It's gambling debts. Monetary systems are gambling systems. For example, you have the same thing with the question of Glass-Steagall. Same issue. Our intent is to utter credit and control credit through federal and state law governing the formation of banking institutions. And the idea was to protect the chartered banks and while keeping the gamblers at a distance. Don't let the gamblers come in and take over the chartered banks, which is what happened under George W. Bush. The gamblers came in and took over the chartered banks. So they were going to have to cancel that. We put it through a bankruptcy reorganization, and these monetary systems will cease to exist because they've been put through bankruptcy reorganization. Now, when somebody comes to us for credit, from the federal government, we say, okay, we have a procedure on credit. Our credit system is controlled by law, by constitutional law. We operate by constitutional law. And this crap that you've been passing off on us is gone. Look what happened, for example. I made the announcement and proposal, first on the 25th of July in my forecast of what was going to happen, which did happen. And then as of the 3 days later, we began to have the great collapse, which I had just forecast. Now, what was the response to it? I laid forth three principal conditions for action by the federal government as interim actions for security, and proposed that this had to go with a general agreement including an international one, to deal with this system. Instead of doing that, under the senator from Connecticut and Barnum and Bailey Frank, we set a series of motions which are clinically insane and potentially criminal. And we have bankrupted our banking system. We have bankrupted the United States through these measures, which, you know, for which Bonnie Frank is the key victim. He's the key target of humor and hate for this reason. Bonnie Frank and his co-conspirators have done more to destroy the U.S. economy than any enemy of the United States could ever conceive of doing. And they've done it from the inside through Wall Street. We're going to have to cancel that. The question is, how many of these people belong in prison, not in the federal government? We need a PCORA commission. And we need a big one this time. That was just a trial run. What we need now is a big one. And if you've got any empty jails around, you know, places in jail, let us know about it. We may have to use those places for people that this new PCORA commission sends there. So that's the point. We have to clean the system up. You have to get an agreement to this. But the argument is, otherwise, how did we get into this mess? Here you have the United States, the most powerful nation the world had ever known, just came out of World War II, had demonstrated, despite Truman, what it was capable of doing, in fact, through Kennedy's work. And we take this great nation of ours, the greatest nation on this planet, which emerged in World War II, is practically the only nation on this planet, prepared to build up the world system of sovereign nation states through a credit system. Then you had, of course, Truman brought in the British, and Roosevelt was going to break up the British Empire. Truman acted to save the British Empire. The United States had freed Indochina from French imperialism. Truman, in backing the British, put the British back in charge of Indochina, recolonized Indochina. The same thing was done to Indonesia. The same thing was done in various forms throughout the world. So where Roosevelt had been committed to a post-war world based on sovereign nation states, Truman and others of his type, his ilk, returned the empire back to the British. This is a virtual act of treason. We had created the greatest nation this world had ever known. We saved the world from Nazism. We did it. Yes, others fought, but without us, we couldn't have won. And we were betrayed again and again and again. We've been looted and betrayed. And those of us who cherish what the United States is, what it represents as the distillation of the best of European civilization, is something we're going to have to defend. And we have to decide, are we going to come to a nicey-nicey agreement with all kinds of assorted people and get into another great compromise of the type that led us to this down the road to this disaster we're in today? You've got to get rid of this legacy of liberalism and go back to defend our Constitution and the principles it expresses. Under those conditions, we, in partnership with nations such as Russia, China, and India, and other nations which would readily join us in that, we can save the world. If we go the compromise way, we can't. You're on the side of humanity or you're not. And people who have questions have got to check their own morality. Are they willing to take the moral position? Are they willing to defend the intent of the Constitution? Are they willing to discuss the intent and assess the issues on the terms of that intent? If not, we're not going to make it. And trying to be nice and nice agreement on this thing is not going to solve the problem. You have to change the habits of people, including the habits of thinking. This country was not put into this mess entirely by the ordinary people of the United States. This country was destroyed by the influential layers, especially the politically influential layers of government. You want to save this planet from the effect of those influential layers? Well, you're going to have to offend them. You're going to have to do things that they may find offensive. but we're going to go back to the principles on which this nation was founded, in the intention which our best presidents and others have represented, in our regard for building a system of sovereign nation states on this planet.
We are going to come back to the question of a PCORA commission and exactly what that commission should be tasked to investigate. But before that, I want to entertain some questions that have come in on the question of the magnitude of the problem here in the U.S. and what is necessary to address it. Lynn, the first question comes from a national official inside the labor movement who is addressing the question of the adequacy of the proposal that was voted up by Congress yesterday at the behest of President-elect Obama. He writes, Mr. LaRouche, according to all estimates, we need approximately 1 million jobs, new jobs per year in the United States just to keep up with our growing population. Before the current crisis hit, under the Bush administration, we averaged something in the area of 800,000, an obvious shortfall. However, over the last year, we lost 2.75 million jobs. And currently, we are losing approximately 500,000 jobs per month. And by all estimates, unless radical action is taken, that will escalate. Right now, we are a minimum of 10 million jobs short just to keep up with our current levels of operation. And that does not get included in any way in official unemployment figures. In addition, there are those people who are not counted as part of the unemployed because they stopped looking for work, and there are those who wish to work full-time but who work part-time who similarly are not counted as unemployed. Those people outside of the millions of Americans who are included in unemployment figures are easily an additional 20 million. So just off the bat, we can identify a minimum of 30 million people who need work who don't appear in anyone's statistics. Even more alarming, according to a recent report that was issued by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, over the course of the next several months, again, if radical action is not taken, 10 million middle-class Americans are going to be thrust into poverty. And an additional 6 million, again, middle-class Americans, will be thrust into what they define as deep poverty, operating at incomes which would amount to 50% of what's currently defined as the poverty level. There is no way around it. This portends a great national catastrophe. Yet, in the midst of this, President Obama's plan, although it does amount to some $800 billion in spending, includes only $90 billion that would go directly toward infrastructure. How do you propose that we address this overall situation, and how can we address it rapidly enough to stop the catastrophe that seems to be looming?
Okay, well, let's be concrete then. These are concrete figures and concrete problems. Now, what I propose is stop kidding yourself about the automobile industry. The automobile industry was destroyed by the U.S. economy, by the government, and by private interests a long time ago. It was destroyed essentially, the process of destruction occurred really in the fiscal year 1967-68, because that was the year in which the net increment of basic economic infrastructure went negative. Now, basic economic infrastructure is concentrated in things which are long-term investments in improvements of public transportation, all kinds of power systems and so forth, with water management systems. Now, these water management systems and power systems have a certain kind of physical lifespan. And the physical lifespan runs between 25 and 50 years, largely. Some are 100 years. For example, in how many communities in which during the 1960s, the residents of that community could draw down safe drinking water, still can do that today? How many people are buying bottled water instead of taking safe drinking water from a faucet? What happened? The system went down. Look at the river systems of the United States. I'll take the principal river system, which is the on the axis of the Mississippi north-south. And it runs in two directions. One is typified by the Tennessee Valley, the Tennessee system, the Ohio system on the one side, and then you get on the other side the western states section in the Missouri River and so forth. Now, what's happened there? First of all, we never developed a system of water management, of comprehensive water management, of river management, north of St. Louis. Secondly, where we had developed one along the Mississippi, along the Ohio, and so forth, it's destroyed. Why? Just attrition. Now, how do we build these systems? Well, as I said some years ago, back in 2005, if we take these the floor space and the people in the communities where had, which used to be the major auto industries, and look back at the history of these institutions. Go back to World War II, for example. How do we make railroads systems? How do we make aircraft for World War II? And so forth. How do we make these systems of water management for rivers? We did it on the top-down approach. We start from science at the top level, physical science. You go down from physical science to machine tool design as a byproduct of science for production, design of the production of the essential components which go into anything. You want to build a national railway system to replace what was destroyed? You want to build a river system to replace what was destroyed? You want to amplify the river system management? What you do is you take the section of the population which is still highly skilled with scientific and related skills. Use that as a cadre. You take the communities in which they used to operate with a large floor space, sometimes used in the past for auto industry, and you take the population of those towns and cities who are accustomed, as culturally, accustomed to working in these kinds of industries, in this kind of production. So instead of producing many automobiles, which it doesn't work, what you do is instead is you produce other things, like a mass transit system. You fix the river system. Now, these are investments which are in the order of magnitude, as I said, up from 25 to 100 years, general order of magnitude. So therefore, what you require is the federal government must create a system of credit at 1 to 2% interest rate for these kinds of long-term projects. So the U.S., instead of going into debt to pay off this and bail out banks, we should take the money back, take it back. Shouldn't have given it out in the first place. My question is, was there really corruption on the part of members of Congress in pushing this thing through? Was the Bush administration actually corrupt, morally corrupt, corruptible? Should it belong, go from the president to the White House to jail over this kind of operation? Because we have to do this. And the only way we can do it is by a credit system where the federal government, in cooperation with the states, creates a debt, which is used to finance large-scale infrastructure. This financing of large-scale infrastructure then becomes the driver for restoring the local communities. Now, you know, a guy who used to work for the auto industry may wish he had not lost his job, but we can take there are other jobs that he can perform in the same area, on the same floor space, using the same assistance or the same machine tool technology as making automobiles. We don't need all these automobiles. We don't need to have somebody smoking into our lungs from the car in front. We don't need that. We need a clean, safe transportation system which of a type which enables us to go back and have family values again. People should not be spending 2 hours each way commuting 5 times a week. No? When in the former time it was, you know, 15 minutes to 20 to half an hour. We don't need to do that anymore. We can go back. We can rebuild the economy. We can build a high-speed transit system, which means we can cut down most short-haul air traffic. We can create locate industries again in a more decentralized way, which means we're distributing it more over the total territory of the United States. We do not encourage super-sized mass corporations. We promote medium-sized corporate structures, except where there's a very special reason for having a larger one. And we concentrate on technological progress, the increase of the productive powers of labor. We emphasize the importance of education for our population for this kind of function. We rehabilitate our environment, which is now going to pot. And this kind of thing, if you've amortized this capitalization through the federal government over a period of respectively 25, 50, 100 years as appropriate, we can do it. We can start with empty banks, virtually empty banks today. So keep that local chartered bank in place. Federal bank, national bank, state bank. Keep it in place. Keep the doors open, even if it's totally bankrupt. We're going to rebuild it. The way we're going to rebuild it, we're going to create capital in terms of long-term credit for necessary projects. And we're going to rebuild the financial capital base of those banks in those communities. Because the community depends upon those banks for all kinds of things, directly or indirectly. And we take that approach. Now, we're talking about the kind of figures we're talking about here. Just think of what that means. It's this. We're going to have to put people back into things like the WPA operation. Yes, true. But we basically want productivity. And that's where we're going to have to go. But it needs a commitment and it requires a credit system. You cannot do it under a monetary system. You cannot do it on the basis of borrowing money from banks, which are a bunch of thieves anyway, and don't have any worthwhile assets there anyway. We're going to have to cancel this bailout. We'll take an institution which is bankrupt and has been gotten a bailout, and I would go in this thing with a PCORA type commission, and I can think I can guarantee we can prove with a capable commission, we can prove as fact, as with the PCORA commission, these guys have got to give the money back. And we're going to take it away from them because we're going to prove they shouldn't have gotten it, that they committed a fraud against the United States and the savings institutions, chartered banks. And we're going to put them into jail, and we're going to do other things. We're going to rebuild what these guys have destroyed since September of 2007. Take that period, 2007. And every bit of every swindle, whether a Barney Frank bailout or something else, every swindle of that type in the Congress or elsewhere, because it was evil. It was wrong. It was an injury to the United States. It was done out of greed, out of corruption. And we'll prove that with an honest replica of the PCORA Commission. And there won't be a person in the United States that doesn't want to hang these guys, including probably the guys themselves. You should hang me. I'm terrible.
Those of you who are listening to today's historic broadcast, we are in a position to take questions from the internet. We will entertain those questions in turn as time allows. Lynn, the next question, once again, comes from some of the people who are involved in transition. And the question is, Mr. LaRouche, I think we all agree that we have to take steps to fix the problems of the banks and the financial institutions. But the fact remains that to pull the economy out of its current slide, we need to give the real economy of work and wages a major boost. In other words, obviously, we've got to get job creation right. And the fact is that I would contend, and the I who is speaking is a very prominent international economist. He says, I would contend that getting job creation right was something that FDR never did. It may sound like a strange thing to say. I mean, after all, we remember, and what we remember most from the 1930s is the WPA, which at its peak employed millions of Americans building roads, schools, and dams. But the New Deal's job creation program, while it certainly helped, was never big enough or sustained enough to end the Great Depression. When an economy is deeply depressed, as ours is, you have to put normal concerns about budget deficits aside. And President Roosevelt never managed to do that. As a result, he was very cautious. And the boost he gave the economy between 33 and 36 was enough to get unemployment down, but not back to pre-depression levels. And in 1937, he let the deficit warriors get to him. And even though our economy was still very weak, he let himself be talked into slashing spending while raising taxes. As you might remember, this led to a severe recession that undid much of the progress the economy had made up to that point. It took the giant public works project known as World War II to shut up the penny pinchers and to bring the Depression to an end. It seems to me that the lesson from FDR's limited success on the unemployment front is that you have to be incredibly bold in your job creation plans. And what that means is that you have to stop worrying about the federal deficit. The fact is that it is going to take hundreds of billions of dollars a year in government spending to address our current problem. My estimate is that you would have to spend a minimum of $800 billion a year simply in job creation to achieve an economic recovery. Spending on this scale is going to produce some very scary numbers vis-a-vis the deficit. But I would argue that not doing it is even more scary. My question to you is, do you agree? And do you have any concerns regarding the federal deficit? Or do you think it's something that we should not worry about under current conditions?
Well, the latter part, the latter part of the remarks I tend to agree with. You're talking about $800 billion to $1 trillion. That doesn't bother me at all. $2 trillion doesn't bother me at all. I think it's what's necessary. And over that kind of period of time indicated, yeah, sure, we're going to have to do it. Now, but I think the error is in certain assumptions critical of Franklin Roosevelt. Your question really slid around that one, and it's a relevant one today. Remember that on the day after Pearl Harbor, many organizations, right-wing organizations in the United States, which is what Roosevelt had to fear, and I'll go back to a little bit more history on this thing, which he had to fear, were his threat. Roosevelt was out to eliminate Adolf Hitler. Remember that Hitler was actually given dictatorial powers through the Reichstag fire days before Roosevelt was inaugurated as president in March. But who inside the United States, Wall Street, the money powers, were full backers of Hitler. They had been full backers of Mussolini. The current president of the United States, as of today, is the grandson of the guy who made the action which saved Adolf Hitler to become the Chancellor of Germany. And they were full Hitler supporters. Prescott Bush was a full Hitler supporter, even beyond Pearl Harbor. So was Harry Truman. What happened is this bunch of fascist bastards, like Prescott Bush, operating with the British, had gained control over the United States through the assassination of William McKinley as president. And Teddy Roosevelt, the nephew of the head, the traitor, the head of the British Intelligence Service for the Confederate States, based in London, was the guy who trained Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was a complete British agent. Taft was what he was. Taft was a traditional Ohio Republican. But Woodrow Wilson came from a family tradition of the Ku Klux Klan. Not only did he have the Ku Klux Klan tradition from the White House itself, he organized the mass reorganization of the Ku Klux Klan, which was a pestilence in the United States during the 1920s and 1930s into the 1940s. I ran into this thing inside the military service back in my days, back in the 1940s. The Klan was a powerful force. And now, what happened though? After Pearl Harbor, the same right-wing organizations, all Wall Street centered, all London centered, all British allies, which had been pro-fascist, pro-Hitler openly during that period, what did they do? They changed their address and mailing address and location. And they're the leading right-wing organizations, lobbying organizations in the United States today. Now, what Roosevelt had to deal with is, remember, the United States orientation had been under Lincoln, and after Lincoln, an orientation toward its chief allies abroad, and major allies. Otto von Bismarck, Chancellor of Germany, Prussia and then Germany. And it was the leadership of U.S. influence internationally what came from Bismarck's mobilization of Germany on a basis of reform, a pro-industrial agricultural reform, which made Germany a great power. And Bismarck was dumped on orders from the Prince of Wales. And he was dumped in order to get World War II, World War I started. As he described it as the intent to have a new 7 Years' War. So the assassination of McKinley, which came from London, organized from London inside the United States, tied into right-wing British circles inside New York City itself. This was a change in policy from a U.S. policy which had been, since Lincoln, oriented toward cooperation with Germany and Russia. Alexander II, third. Had been from the organization of the Trans-Siberian Railroad, the development of the great railway systems of Eurasia, were all products of the United States' influence on these friends and allies in Europe. What had happened is then we, by the assassination of Wilson, of McKinley, by we turned around, ran a witch hunt against German immigrants into the United States during the period leading into World War I, and we became an ally of Britain against Europe. The right-wing influence represented by Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt before him dominated as a pro-fascist organization openly, initially pro-Mussolini, and then pro-Hitler, organized that in Europe. That's what we fought against in World War II. That's a problem that Roosevelt had in politics. A right-wing group, still the same right-wing group today, are these right-wing think tanks. They're still the same fascist bastards they were then. And that is a problem. And it was a problem for Roosevelt. Roosevelt, the United States knew, U.S. intelligence knew, naval and military intelligence, up until 36, the official policy was that Japan, as an ally of England, was going to conduct a destruction of the U.S. naval forces in a planned war. Japan's target, assigned target from Britain, was to organize an attack upon Pearl Harbor, the Pearl Harbor Naval Base. That was in the 1920s. Now, at a certain point, the British, and for certain special reasons, particularly with the invasion of France by Germany during World War I, World War II, the British decided that they had to defend their interests by going with the United States against Hitler, where they had proposed and supported Hitler before then as an instrument for a war against Russia, against the Soviet Union. So they changed sides. With the Pearl Harbor attack, the right wing in the United States scampered because the British had deserted them on the intent, on their intent here. But they simply changed their names and addresses. And the same factor centered in Wall Street today as then is the enemy we have to contend with from within. This is the problem we have. Now, Roosevelt was hampered, but what did he do? And the idea of this short thing, that he turned around here and there, no, that's true, not true at all. It wasn't Roosevelt alone that did his plant his policy. It was the U.S. military. Leading generals of the United States, leading admirals of the United States, who were prepared for this war with Britain, this war against Hitler, to defend the United States against the attack on Pearl Harbor planned. What did they do? Well, under Jack Pershing and Black Jack Pershing and others, we organized. We organized what became the Harry Hopkins operation during the 1930s. And Roosevelt was operating against, even though the Pecora Commission and so forth did their job, he was operating against this crowd, this British crowd, which still controls the U.S. politics today. So yes, what the fact is true that Roosevelt was restrained and was conditioned by threats from Wall Street and similar forces during the 1930s. But when he acted on the basis of plans which had been pioneered by the U.S. military, including Billy Mitchell, during the 1920s, and on the basis of careful preparations for war mobilization before. Now, if you look at this thing not from the standpoint of jobs and so forth, and usual kind of financial gossip, what happened was, and I saw it, being 86 years of age, I tended to see a few things some of you guys, other guys missed. You weren't there when this was going on. We had a transformation in the productive powers of labor before, and you can look at this in physical terms. You know, what the difference between us and the Nazis, and the Germans had a much better military capability than we had. But why did we win? Because where they had hundreds of pounds of logistical support, we had tons. We were able to outproduce every nation in the world per capita in physical output of anyone. What happened to us was Truman. Truman was on the other side. I was there. Truman destroyed our potential to convert the raw making potential into an industrial, post-industrial potential. We went through a virtual depression into 48 as a result of this shutdown of the potential productive capability the United States had acquired during under Roosevelt and during World War II. This conversion. Roosevelt was committed to a post-war world in which the British Empire would be broken up, knowing that there is no United States until we get rid of the British Empire. There wasn't then and there isn't today. You get rid of the British Empire or you don't get a United States ever again. The problem was we lost the ability through Truman, through Truman's treasonous betrayal. And Truman was part of the right-wing faction. And Truman's betrayal, we lost the ability to do what we should do. We still had remnants of that in the 1950s under Eisenhower. It was reflected in President Kennedy's initiative on the space program and on the industrialization program. But if you look at it, we were being ruined step by step throughout the post-war period. And 1968, that fiscal year, you look at the figures, the physical figures. Look at the aging figures and the physical figures. We went from a positive to a negative rate of growth in basic economic infrastructure at that point. And we lost our industrial potential in the same way. Now, what we lost were assets which had a 50 to 100 year range of asset value. And therefore, it took time before the accumulation of the decadence of our industry and our infrastructure caught up with us. But we have been degenerating every year, all year long, over the entire period from then to the present day. What we've reached globally is a result of policy. We reached a global condition where the rate of hyperinflation in the so-called financial derivatives area and the collapse in physical production and trade, and physical trade, has reached a point that the system is finished. We're finished. The world is finished. And yeah, what you said at the end, fine, it's true. And you're too modest. How about two trillion a year? Be more sensible, more likely. And it would have to be a Roosevelt type, like what Roosevelt did, unleashed in World War II. Not in war, but in basic economic infrastructure development on a global scale. And it's going to be big, so you have to regulate it. You just can't have the money out there as inflationary money. You have to control it. You control it under a credit system. You freeze it, fixed exchange rate system. And you can postpone the reconciliation of accounts according to a schedule. You have treaty agreements with other nations where you have these exchanges, and you regulate this to negotiate. And the smart thing you have to have in government is the people who can do that job, who know how to do it. And I think in our records of our history, you find people in the diplomatic field and others who in the past have understood how to do this. And we just simply have to call their skill and revive it and use it again.
Okay, this is another question from Transition on the question of jobs and infrastructure. And this one is likely to cause some excitement. The questioner says, Mr. LaRouche, one of the biggest problems you're going to face as you try to rescue this economy will be finding enough job creation projects that can be started quickly. Traditional WPA-type programs, spending on roads, government buildings like schools, ports, and other kinds of hard infrastructure, are without question our most effective tool for creating employment and for creating wealth. But America probably has less than $150 billion worth of such projects that are shovel-ready right now. And what I mean by that are projects that we could actually start in 6 months or less. So one of the things we are faced with is that we have to be creative. We have to find lots of other ways to push funds into this economy. Yes, as much as possible, we want to spend on things of lasting value. Things like roads and bridges. They make us a richer and a better nation. But there are other things that we are looking at. Upgrading the infrastructure behind the internet. Upgrading the electrical grid from the standpoint of computerization. Improving information technology in the healthcare sector, which is a crucial part of any healthcare reform, as well as providing aid to state and local governments to prevent them from cutting investment spending at precisely the wrong moment. It seems to us that as we do this, all of this spending will do double duty. It serves the future, but it also helps the present by providing jobs and income to offset the slump. Obviously, some of the jobs that we're referring to are in areas that are not traditionally defined as hard infrastructure, but they are nevertheless necessary and beneficial. in the past, you seem to have been very skeptical about the benefit of job creation in this area. Would you please comment on this?
The problem is when you start talking about these concerns in monetary terms, rather than physical scientific terms, you come up with mistakes, serious mistakes. The kind of jobs I've deprecated in the past are worthless jobs. They create nothing, no net benefit to the economy in terms of growth. Now, you want to get serious, get serious. How many fourth generation nuclear power plants are you willing to commit yourself to build? Now, you're going to do that and by obvious methods, which are the type we used for production in World War II. Fourth generation nuclear power is it. If you're going to use a lower energy flux density source of power, cut it out. You're wasting your time. You're babbling. The so-called green sources of power. Crap. Solar energy is power. Crap. You want to benefit from solar energy? Give it to the plants. I mean, just take the case of this. How idiotic people are who accept this green revolution nonsense. Take chlorophyll. Now, to describe it in simplistic terms, what does chlorophyll do? Chlorophyll is a molecule which looks like a polywog. It has a long tail, which is really a kind of antenna, and it has a head with a magnesium atom in the center of this head. Now, what this thing does, it takes sunlight, solar radiation, which is captured by tuning by this tail. And it's not actually an individual molecule, but it's a plaque of the whole group of these things working together. It's not sexual, but they work together. And what happens is this power comes in at a low energy flux density. Because when the sunlight hits the surface of the earth, this is poor crap. You can get a sunburn out of it, you can get sick, you can destroy the environment and create deserts, but it's lousy. If you want anything good out of sunlight, grow a green plant. If you want to have a good effect, it's good to have grown grasses, it's good to have bushes. Not George bushes, but real bushes. It's very good to have advanced forms of tree life. Because what happens is when the green, the chlorophyll, transforms the solar power, which is captured by the antenna, and transforms it to an increase in energy flux density, the equivalent of a higher temperature. It is this increase in energy flux density which results in the normal process of cooling the environment, providing the conditions of life for growing vegetables and animal life, and so forth. So therefore, your measurement of performance is not calories. Calories are things you wear, especially when you get very fat. What you want is you want higher energy flux density. You want to go to a higher order of organization of living things. With solar energy, you produce deserts. With green, with trees, through chlorophyll, which transforms sunlight from a low energy flux density to a higher energy flux density, the whole life cycle of the planet is generated. Now, the problem is that most of this so-called stuff that I have deprecated, I've deprecated for that reason. Do you want a desert? Then create a nation covered with solar reflectors. You will produce a desert. You will starve people to death. Stop this solar collector nonsense. It's insane. There are no green alternatives to nuclear power. None. If you don't want nuclear power, then get out and commit suicide now. Get it over with. You want to kill your neighbor? Kill nuclear power. It's the best way to do it. You don't even have to get your hands dirty. Just that's all it takes. So The point is the issue of creativity. And the problem with most economists and most economic institutions, they don't know what creativity is. They've never understood the science of creativity from a physical science standpoint. And therefore, the secret of power is called energy flux density. It's the equivalent of higher temperatures. And you're talking about thousands of times greater power in nuclear power than in any other form of power, such as petroleum or natural gas or so forth. And that's what you need. Now, if you are increasing the productive powers of labor in this way, that's the way to go. And if you wanted to get this effect, give me the auto industry. Let me reorganize it. Let's produce a national rail maglev system. Get people off the highways and move them more efficiently. Cut out these short-haul flights, which are a waste of time and dangerous. Build nuclear power plants, lots of them. And see how soon you've made a capital investment which will transform this economy. Think of ways of increasing green. And we have knowledge of how to do that. Improve the environment. Improve water systems. Desalination. Improve water systems. Take the Western Desert, these large projects. Take the American Desert on the west and save it, as in northern Mexico too. You're going to change the environment. You're going to increase the productive powers of labor. You're going to the output per capita. And it's creativity, which is specific to human beings as opposed to monkeys. How do you think a human being who looks like a gorilla or looks like a chimpanzee, sometimes acts like one, and how do you get a population and a few millions of individuals, in the case of these higher anthropoids, and how do you get a human population of 6.5 million people? Oh, through creativity. The creative powers of the human mind, which most economists don't admit to exist, these applied to development of society, increase the power of man per capita per square kilometer, as expressed in growing things and other things. All of this involves scientific and tech-related progress. And it's capital intensity, in the sense of science intensity, which is the secret of productivity. If you want to get people occupied and assume that they do some good because you employed them, that's nonsense. You have to think in terms of creativity. And you want to find all the civilizations of the world which were against technological and scientific progress and look at them. We call them the undeveloped people, undeveloped nations, the undeveloped territories. The advantage of European civilization, and particularly in its development since the Westphalia, has been that when we didn't have wars caused by the British Empire, similar things, human civilization, the power and quality of life of the human individual, has increased more greatly than ever before in all human existence. And every problem we've had has been something which distracted from that objective or suppressing it. And there's nothing more deadly, more anything that we want to humanity, than this green and this green anti-nuclear, etc. technology. This is the most inhuman thing currently existing on the planet, because it's the thing that stands in the way of the kind of investments which we need and we could make, which would save humanity from the terrible crisis it faces today.
Thank you, Lynn. Obviously, for all the individuals who had submitted questions dealing with green jobs, the issue of nuclear power, et cetera, I think that Mr. LaRouche did sufficiently answer them, contained in his answer to the last question. So I'm going to move on to one more question on the domestic package, and then we will entertain some of the questions that have come in on the issue of a PCORA commission. Lynn, this is a question, again, from Transition. And it's on the issue of spending outside of spending for job creation. The questioner says, Mr. LaRouche, one of the things that we have been discussing at length here is that you can do well by doing good. And let me explain what I mean by this. Americans who are hit hardest by the current economic crisis are the long-term unemployed, families without health insurance, and people who generally are living below the poverty line. These are also the Americans who are most likely to spend any aid they receive, and thereby aid to them helps sustain the economy as a whole. Again, aid to the distressed, enhanced unemployment insurance, food stamps, health insurance subsidies, is something that it seems to us must be done because it is the fair thing to do, but it is also a desirable part of any short-term economic plan. We understand that it certainly is not enough to offset what right now is being identified as the most significant decline in private spending since the Second World War. One of the things that we are looking at is that it also makes sense to cut taxes on a temporary basis. But the tax cuts we're talking about are tax cuts that would go primarily to lower and middle income Americans. Again, both because it's the fair thing to do, but also because they are more likely to spend their so-called windfall than those more affluent. I want to be clear in asking this question. We know very, very well that tax cuts are not the tool of choice for fighting an economic slump, nor are things like enhanced unemployment, food stamps, etc. Without question, they deliver a lot less bang for the buck than infrastructure spending, and there certainly is no guarantee that consumers will spend their tax cuts or their rebates, etc. We know that you have to spend more than $300 billion in this area to compare with spending of approximately $200 billion in what we would refer to as public works. However, we've been forced to address this because any move to aid these distressed Americans elicits a response, especially from Capitol Hill, and we should be clear, that response is from both Republicans and Democrats, that such measures are inflationary and will cause more problems than they solve. It is our view that that outlook is really born more out of a refusal to accept the depth of the current crisis and the suffering of these Americans than anything else. But we still wanted to address this question to you because it is a real issue of how much we can and should spend to help people.
The problem is, you know, I'm an economist, and most of the people who are called economists really aren't. And therefore, I think differently than people think in terms of spending money or not spending money or this or that. Really, that is not what counts. There are certain aspects of controlling expenditure which are not expenditure. For example, when you go, you take a public transportation system, a rapid transit public transportation system, municipal and so forth. It's better to have that virtually free. Then people shouldn't pay at all for it. So that it never enters the economy as a pass-through of choice of spending money. For example, in New York City, when the transportation system was very cheap, you know, the nickel, all right, it worked much better. And increasing the price of mass transit was crazy. It was demonstrated in the case of New York City that if you wanted to improve the economy of the New York transit system, cut out the fares. In other words, if the cost of maintaining the fare collection system was the factor which tilted the system in favor of losses. if you have a completely free system where people just walk on as to a sidewalk and walk into a public transportation facility rather than a sidewalk, the economic benefit is great. Now, the same thing is true in health. Just take the case of the public health care now, the public area of health care. We used to operate with general hospital systems. And look what happened in New York City with Felix Rohatyn on hospitals. Which system is better? Is it better to have people going to hospitals where they're treated, period, first? And if there's any collection of fees, that comes second. Because your objective in public health is public health. You're fighting against disease. You're fighting for a healthy population. And if you have a good public health system with general hospitals and so forth and these kinds of institutions, you're able to deliver. It's better to spend money invisibly, not as money, but as a public system that's required. Power systems. Let's take, for example, water systems. How much has the country lost by losing public free water systems? Or virtually free water systems? How much is it lost? How much do these crazy little bottles, plastic bottles, cost you? Drink this stuff. No, it's wrong. And besides, you want people to take more water. You want people older to take 2 to 3 liters of water a day. You make it an item, and a poor person will cut down on drinking water. You may increase the problem of illness. That sort of thing. Public transportation. You don't want people driving automobiles all over the place. You ever get in a traffic jam as a regular part of work? It's crazy. You don't want people jammed up. We used to have, in my youth and young adulthood, a typical person working person, factory, whatever, would take 15 minutes to a half an hour commuting at most, sometimes just by walking to work. And with this kind of change, this centralization, the decentralization and centralization process, which ruined this. So therefore, this is not the issue. The real issue is, what is productivity? We went to a post-industrial society, which means we also went to an idea of globalization. So now, instead of getting food grown in your area, you have it imported from a great distance at great cost. It's a high price, you can't afford it, and so forth. So what we're doing in terms of our economic system, what has become customary, and as the questioner put it, when you describe the system in that way, you enter into a domain of insanity. But the insanity is the mass insanity which is built into the habits we have accepted over 2 to 3 generations as a result of a wrong direction of the economy as a whole. As I go back to the nuclear power question, just think of producing 100 nuclear power plants a year, fourth generation, inside the United States. Now, we could do that. That can be done. We can provide there high-grade jobs, not poor jobs. You can upgrade people constantly. If you do large-scale water systems, you increase the productivity of land area in production of product per capita per square kilometer. That's what you want. So don't accept this idea that price, money, this is the answer. Don't think like an accountant. Send the accountant into retirement. Think like an economist, not like an accountant. Don't think about juggling payments and money and so forth. Forget it. This is a racket. It's because people believed in this system that they made step by step the wrong decisions at the polls and so forth. And these wrong decisions have taken us down the road toward the disasters being described. Don't try to learn how to live with disease. Cure it.
Okay, we're going to move on to deal with some of the questions that have come in regarding Mr. LaRouche's endorsement of a new PCORA commission. Lynn, the first question is one that you're familiar with. We've discussed it before, but the question thought it important to address it in a public forum. He says, Lynn, one of the things that we're faced with when we talk about a PCORA Commission style investigation is the difference in the way the system was structured back in the 30s and the way that it is structured now. Specifically, because so much of the problem that we face is conducted outside the borders of the United States, my question to you is, can we conduct such an investigation without international cooperation? Specifically, we know that the City of London will resist such an investigation with every tool at their disposal. What about the Russians? Is there anything that would block them from enthusiastic endorsement of such a proposal? And if so, how should we here in the U.S. address it?
You know, there's a principle in society called leadership. And often the term is misused, misunderstood. Society functions on the basis of leadership. And, you know, in the area I deal with, particularly with younger people, in the area of creativity, I get the real question of leadership. To me, real leadership involves creativity. And I mean creativity in the sense of scientific creativity, which has many other reflections in art, classical artistic composition. When you have people who have a populist culture of the type we have today, like the so-called popular entertainment culture, all these features, you are destroying the moral and character and also the aptitudes of the population. What's happened with the Beatles, we have all become Beatles. And you go six pair of legs or something and you become a super beetle. No, we become degenerate. Now, what the problem here is twofold. First of all, many people out there, particularly people who have intellectual concerns, realize that this stinks. And they're a threshold away from saying so. But they look around at their friends and neighbors and the people they work with in general, and they say, I don't want to say that. I don't want to get in trouble. I got to keep my nose clean. I don't want to be in trouble. And there is a system of terror, in particular, which was built in with the right-wing turn in the post-Roosevelt period after World War II. This right-wing terror led to a kind of conformity. It's like H.G. Wells or some kind of other similar kind of conformity. And people lie all the time. They lie so much they don't know what a lie is anymore. They lie because they want to be accepted. They say things because they want to be influential, not because of what they're saying. They don't think of the truth of what they're saying, the effect of what they're saying. They don't care. They want to be accepted. Keep your nose clean. Look, don't get into trouble. You know, shut up. Don't say that. You get into trouble. So you have a population which is conditioned more than ever before in the United States population, more than before, to complete conformity, complete depravity. And this was I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I mean, you can't find your way across town without a conspiracy theory. People who don't believe in conspiracy theories should be put in, tanks where they can swim around the water and supervise and don't go anyplace. Then they don't have to conspire. They can just swim anywhere they want to and whatnot. But we have people who are stupid. They become more stupid because they don't use their brains. But nonetheless, some of us, including some of my questioners today, think. And I encourage them to think. I think it's a noble practice, and people who think, who are problem solvers, not faddists who follow popular magazine tastes or something like that, who think actually are able to influence people around them. And the problem we have today, in my experience, is the people who are capable of thinking have been largely intimidated and corrupting into not actually applying this ability to think as a function of leadership in society. In other words, you bring up a subject, everybody in the room perhaps will agree with what you're saying, but they don't want you to say it. And what you're not saying is exactly what you should be talking about making a decision. And what you have is you have the case of someone who speaks up and says the unspeakable, which happens to be true. And people are suffering and realize that what you're talking about pertains to the reason they're suffering, or that somebody else is suffering. And they respect leadership. What is needed in society is that quality of leadership, of people who will stand up and think clearly and propose changes. And you find that when you get a group of people, a few people in a crowd, and a few people in a crowd who actually do thinking, can influence a large part of that number of people. And the problem today is people are looking for acceptance, and they're trying to be overheard saying something they think will find gratification because it's not egregious. And therefore, the fear of being egregious is the greatest mother of stupidity in society today. And that's where the problem lies. If we're willing to tell the truth and willing to realize that leadership is a difference. Like scientific creativity is the epitome of that, great scientific discoveries. And they are the leaders of society. They are the conscience of society. And those who say, don't do it, don't upset don't make enemies, don't rock the boat. And what's needed now is boat rockers. And people have to sit back who are serious, and I think many of the questions here, of course, are serious. Think back, look, how much of this you're talking about is pure crap? How much of it is crap you're saying because it's what you think is expected of you by your peers, or what will be tolerated by people who you want to influence? Why not take a chance once in a while and say what you believe to be true, actually, not what you want to be overheard saying? And I think a lot of the questioning comes in that direction. The questions come out about things that people have not been thinking about. Questions come up in the form of assuming that money is the magic of economy. And say, well, money works this way, money works that way. But then I look around and I go into factories and nobody's working. Money's all over the place, but no one's working. So the question here is one of creativity. Is the creativity there? Is the quality of leadership present with people who have the guts to stand up? And that's our problem.
Okay, Lynn, I have, again, on the question of the PCORA Commission, these are two questions. They're very similar. They came from slightly different sources. I'm going to read sections of both of them because I'm not quite sure how to kind of mush them together. And it's a bad word, but it was the best one I could come up with. The first question says, Mr. LaRouche, I'm really more of a historian than an economist, but I've been asked to look at this and to make recommendations. And there are certain things about the PCORA Commission that really do stand out. One is that the original PCORA Commission not only documented a litany of abuses that had been committed by financiers, but it also paved the way for remedial legislation. Obviously, the Securities Act of 1933, Glass-Steagall, the Securities Exchange Act of 34, all were an outgrowth of what the PCORA Commission brought to light. Today, there are many who argue that the current calamitous meltdown of our system is a national calamity, but that it's a natural calamity without any identifiable culprits. Mm-hmm. And they say to us, well, how important is it to identify those culprits? My view of this and my recommendation is that the nation really does have to be led step by step through all the machinations that led to the present debacle. And then and only then can we begin to shape wise legislation to prevent reoccurrence. Now, we got a very similar question from Capitol Hill, again, from someone who is looking very closely at this question. And that questioner says, the original PCORA Commission exposed the way J.P. Morgan and others dominated the U.S. economy and used it to suit their own goals. But above everything else, it built a constituency for FDR to do what he wanted to do, which was to force Congress to pass tough regulatory reform, the pillar of which was Glass-Steagall, blah, 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 blah. But there was a very big difference between then and now. Then, people still believed that a strong agro-industrial base was the pillar of a strong economy. It seems to me that to be effective, a new PCORA Commission, in addition to targeting the J.P. Morgans of today, has to address how our population abandoned the idea that a strong agro-industrial base was the equivalent or was necessary for a strong economy. Wouldn't we have to also investigate how deregulation and probably globalization itself, the so-called free market system, if you will, replace the system that FDR relied upon to get us out of the last depression?
I didn't write the question. But I'm going to answer it. That's the problem. The objection, the qualification is the problem. The conditions today are worse than they were then. The sanity of the population is less than it was then. The morality of the population is far less than it was then. Lower. And the question, what people have to confront is the fact that the idea of globalization and deregulation, that these conceptions are the disease. And to understand that more, that if we don't correct that disease, we are at the end of our existence as a nation and a civilization. You have to give up your prejudice or your life. You got a choice. Because if you're going to go along with globalization and these other kinds of alternative to work, to production, to skill, if you're going to do that, you're going to die, and you're going to die a horrible death, and you're going to take your society down with you. Let's assume that there's some people who have the quality of leadership in society who will say, I am determined to save society even against its own stupidity. Would you protect your children from jumping into a fire? And these guys are worse than children. Would you act to protect them, to keep them from destroying themselves, their families, their community, and their nation? That's a question of morality. And if you pose that question in the sense of, but don't we have to consider this? No, we don't have to consider this except as a crime. This kind of stuff is what's destroyed this society. And it's our toleration of this kind of crap, the acceptance of globalization, the acceptance of non-work as a form of work. You know, trying to say, well, isn't prostitution productive in some way or other? Oh, yeah, only by accident. That's the problem. And therefore, no, you have to go by productive values. And people who don't have productive values are of no use to society in terms of political policy. The problem is in society that far too many people, especially Wall Street types, who don't give a damn of what they do for society, its effect, but they get the largest amount of money, the greatest amount of control in society. Look at golden parachutes. You have a parasite moves into a firm in a short period of time, takes over the firm, leaves with a golden parachute, and leaves the people who had worked in that firm destitute. This is immoral. And the way to do it is you deal with it, you just say, hey, you stupid jerk, How immoral can you get? And you just have to take that attitude. You have to establish the question of what is the standard of acceptable behavior. And if your neighbor is not being acceptable, tell him so. If you're not willing to do that, you're not going to get a change. If you don't get a change, you're not going to get a society. Right now, you've got to the point, either you've got the guts to stand up against the so-called popular opinion that has these new values and say, this is crap. It's you. You are the criminal. Yes, that guy got $10 million for doing it. You got five. You got 10,000. I mean, he's just as big a criminal as he is, just not as successful at it.
Okay. Lynn, there are, these questions came in related to the issue of the PCORA Commission, but they also address some other questions which came from all over the place. Number one is the question of the illegal drug trade. The question of the relationship between the illegal drug trade and the financial system came up in the form of a question as to whether or not this should be a target of a PCORA Commission investigation. It also came up as a question from Russia, from Latin America, particularly Mexico, and also here. Broadly, the question is, without the cooperation of the international banking system to launder all of the money that comes from the drug trade, it would seem that the drug traffickers would essentially be drowned by the sheer amount of cash that they have to deal with. The question is, on the overall issue of the relationship between the illegal drug trade and the financial system, while I think many of us agree it should be thoroughly investigated, is this something that would come under a PCORA Commission investigation, or is it too big for that? Does it require a whole separate approach in terms of dealing with what has now become a gigantic problem for the entire world, and which is an alarming problem just south of the border with Mexico?
Well, there's no difference in the two categories. Not at all. The international drug trafficking operation is an integral part of the big money people operations in the world, the scandalous ones, entirely. I take the case of George Soros, for example. How influential is George Soros politically in the United States? Isn't his very presence in the United States a crime, considering what he does? Isn't, what about his influence on elections in the United States? His influence on the Democratic Party leadership inside the United States? His influence on the members of the Congress in the United States? Is that not corruption? This is beyond corruption. It's really satanic. Look at the conditions of life in Mexico. Look at the conditions of life in South America. Look at the conditions all over the world. For example, you have the Southwest Asia, drug trafficking. Now, what's a farmer get for a crop, an opium crop, in a year? It's hundreds of dollars. What is it by the time that product of that reaches Europe or the United States? It's up to 10,000 times as much valuation to the trafficking as that. The international drug trafficking is one of the biggest operations in the world, in financial operations. It's also the greatest cause of suffering in the world, in terms of the effects of this. Now, in case of Southwest Asia or Russia, this is a question of a strategic threat. When you take the relationship of George Soros into his operation in Russia, including our Ukraine or other areas, George Soros's drug trafficking is an existential threat to a major nation, to a major nuclear power. You look at South America, the only nation in South America presently which is seriously fighting the drug trafficking is Colombia. And Colombia has the greatest experience with it. We are having a threat to the United States from that, from the Mexican border into the United States, which is an existential threat to the United States as well as to the nation of Mexico. So therefore, if that is not a crime for immediate consideration and action as a case of corruption, then what is a crime? Drug trafficking is the most characteristic, this type, is the most characteristic crime of the time. This is the one we should be the quickest to get rid of. If we don't get rid of this drug trafficking, we're not going to have a civilization. If we don't get rid of George Soros' influence, we're not going to have a civilization. I don't think there's much of a better, well, than the British interest, like his friend Malik Brown, in doing what they're doing in Colombia. The worst murder, the worst crime on this planet is being committed by these people. If we don't consider that a crime, if that's not a motive for investigation, the very fact that somebody's involved with this kind of operation in administration and finance, when the amount of money involved is involved, when you look at the effect of that in terms of the drug trafficking, the effect of that in communities, what more do you need as evidence for a PCORA-type investigation? And that's we are being destroyed by this, by the negligence in not dealing with this, and therefore we have to deal with it.
The next question, Lynn, again, came in one form from one of the people who's working on the question of how to shape a PCORA commission in terms of the targets that should be looked at. But a related question came from the Belarus Development Group in the Republic of Belarus. So I'm going to read the first one and then the second one and let you deal with them together, because they both deal with the question of the oil markets. The question from the U.S. says, he says, one of the things that we've been forced to confront here in the U.S. is the way in which the oil markets have been essentially rigged via the spot market. The bottom line in terms of what we are looking at is that you have a gigantic pool of U.S. dollars abroad. And this phenomena of the petrodollar market has allowed the United States to be flooded with speculative money. Something that is of even greater concern, however, is that money has also been able to exert a considerable amount of control over the status of the dollar itself. It seems to us that we have to find a way to address this and to remedy it, because our currency has become, under current conditions, something which is subject to attack. Now, from Belarus, the question is different. From Belarus, the question is, Mr. LaRouche, as I'm sure you know, the Persian Gulf countries recently agreed to introduce a common currency on January 2010. On that date, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, and Kuwait will introduce a common currency. Will this take the petroleum trade out of the U.S. dollar sphere? And if so, what impact will that have on the U.S. and on the global economy as a whole?
We'll take the second question first. In 1973, you had the spot market was a very small part of the total petroleum market. The long-term contracts were generally the determination of delivery of petroleum. Now, you had a sequence of 1971, the breakup of the fixed exchange rate system, under the initiative of Nixon. And then you had the 1973, you had the Saudis cut a deal with the British Empire, which was called the Great Spot Market Run of 1973 on. And what they did was they launched an agreement under which the British Empire and the Saudis would share a slush fund of vast magnitudes because of the difference, based on the difference between the price of the petroleum at port in the Gulf and the price in the market associated with Anglo-Dutch liberal Europe. So this slush fund created the greatest strategic slush fund in the world, associated with things like BAE. And much of the terrorist operations of the world are funded through that, to that operation. This became the combination, the destruction of the power of the US dollar as a system occurred then. Now, we've come to the end of that cycle, in a sense. We're now on the verge of a total collapse of the entire international monetary financial system. And what is being proposed, which is largely a Saudi operation, which is focused on the trading coming through Dubai, which is the center of this, which is also a center of reference for international terrorism and things like that. This is a crucial part of the entire operation. And that's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with a swindle of a monopoly. First of all, we're starting with an anti-nuclear energy monopoly. If we had not, in the same period, with the inauguration of Jimmy Carter, if we had not broken up the nuclear power development programs, which was done arbitrarily by the British and by the United States under British influence in that period, 77. If that had not been done, you could not have had the development of the monopoly in petroleum then. Because the obvious thing is petroleum is a very cheap product at its source of extraction, especially from Saudi Arabia. And therefore, what makes it costly are two things. First of all, you transport it long distance, so you have a relatively heavy weight at a low price. You travel at a high price, so the increment of cost is largely located in the transport of the product. It's stupid, right? Well, we had nuclear power plants are coming along. Now, if you get to a high density nuclear power reactor, you now go to producing hydrogen-based fuels as a byproduct of nuclear operations. When you go to a higher density, you're talking about order of magnitude of thousands, and you go to a higher density power resource, you no longer depend upon petroleum from around, being shipped from around the world from these markets under these spot market controls. You're no longer fixed. You now, the nuclear power plant is producing the hydrogen-based fuels which are used in any local area and other things. Under these conditions, you would have national control, especially by industrial powers, of their own power resources. What you had by shifting out to this other thing, you now created a monopoly. And this became what the transfer of the British Empire from the Anglo-Dutch liberal financial system into the Anglo-Dutch Saudi political system, which is also the center of international terrorism today. This was a product of this change. Obviously, we break it up. And the way to break it up most efficiently is by going full tilt with nuclear power. And when you think about the factors of employment, which large-scale advanced nuclear power stations represent on a mass level, a transformation of the world physical economy on this basis, you solve the problem. And that's the way you have to go with this thing.
Okay, we have time for two more questions. Lynn, this question is one that has been asked in different forms from literally every continent. The development movement in Russia asks the question in one way. People who are concerned with the current situation in the Middle East have asked the question in terms of how it relates to the situation right now and Israel's aggression. And it's come up as a question relating to what is really behind the current Ukrainian-Russian gas crisis. But essentially, the question is, Mr. LaRouche, what is the danger? What is the likelihood that those individuals and institutions on a global level who were incapable of keeping the world from plunging into economic chaos will now instead unleash a hot war to stop the kinds of remedies to the economic chaos that clearly are now being considered? How worried should we be about the parting shots of this Bush administration as part of that configuration?
Yes, right, that's it. Now, you wanting to defeat them? Question is, are you willing to defeat these bastards? It's that simple. I know this myself. We are, what is happening right now, I mean, Cheney is involved, say, in the Ukraine operation with Soros. So you have two of the worst scum on the planet, Soros and Cheney, are involved in this operation. Cheney is involved, was involved, we have this operation referred to before. In January of 2008, you had this plan, this alternative plan, for getting Israel to be deployed for an operation in the Gaza Strip. And it was more than the Gaza Strip. And it was going to happen after the November election in the US. It happened. Now, the Israelis were already in on it in January. And, you know, everybody was planned, primed. The British were running it. And it was done through Cheney. Cheney was essentially a British agent more than anything else. Was a key in this thing. In the Ukraine thing, again, George Soros. And George Soros set up this operation. Then Cheney came in on the operation to run an operation against Russia and against Europe using the right wing in Ukraine, which are completely controlled by the London Soros crowd. That's the way it works. Now, imagine what that means. If that were to go ahead, the danger is a general conflict, particularly under present condition, and it's uncontrollable and unpredictable as to what will or will not happen. But if you're talking about a threat of World War III and IV, that's the implication. Russia is a nuclear state. Its very existence is being imperiled by these operations. And the threat against Russia of a nuclear character is also there. Would they react? My tendency is to believe that they would act. You can be looking at World War III, nuclear World War III. And it's our job, those who are sensible, is to crush this. Things like Gaza should never have happened. It should have been prevented. And force should have been brought to bear to make sure it didn't happen. This was not, didn't come by surprise. We knew about this in January of 2008. We knew it was on the table. We wrote about it. And nothing happened we didn't write about. It was known. It was a British operation. We didn't do anything about it. Then it happened. Now look what it means. Now look what they're doing now in Ukraine. This was also targeted for the case of Iran. For example, what do? They did the Gaza operation, and some missiles, which are Iranian manufactured, are being transferred to the area of Lebanon. Somebody grabs these missiles and then fires them at Gaza, the Gaza Strip area, in that area. against Israel. What are they trying to do? We didn't stop it. It was known. U.S. intelligence services were fully aware of this. Why didn't we stop it? Don't you think this is Pecora Commission type material? Why didn't we stop it? Why didn't the administration stop it? We knew it was going to happen. We knew Cheney was involved. Why didn't we stop it? Who is it? Nancy Pelosi? Mrs. Blousy? Now that's the questions that come up. We are, this kind of thing is unpredictable in the sense of what form it can take. But whatever form it will take ain't good. And it ain't good so bad that we have to do something about it. The first thing we have to do is to expose it. And we have to make it stink as it should. And rub it in people's nostrils. Otherwise it's gonna happen. Or something like it.
Okay. Before I ask the last question, I should mention that certainly we have far more questions than time allowed us to entertain today. We also have, especially from here in Washington, a whole group of questions that people submitted but asked that Lynn not be asked publicly until after President Obama has taken the oath of office, so that I can promise you that everything that we took up here today will be addressed once again, probably in even more detail, when we come together again at 1 o'clock on January 22nd. And I want to invite people to come back and to listen with us then, and to submit their questions then. I also think that given the pace of events, both domestically and internationally, there will be many other areas that Mr. LaRouche will also be asked to address. But in concluding today's event, this is a question that came from a group that really goes way beyond simply the transition group, and really I think is better described as some of the senior members of what we would talk about as the institution of the presidency. And they say, Mr. LaRouche, as you know, for many of us, the president-elect was not necessarily our candidate of first choice. Nevertheless, as we've come together to shape the policy options of this new administration, we must say that we are optimistic. And we are optimistic even as each day seems to bring a new, more escalated phase of the problems that we have to contend with. We're interested in knowing your view of this. Certainly, you've contributed a great deal in terms of specifics and in terms of broad ideas as we embark on the shaping of the policies that our nation so desperately requires. But when all is said and done, are you optimistic? I know the answer to that.
Well, I've been emphasizing for some time, and more so as this presidency has been coming in, that we have to understand ourselves from a higher level than the usual press and related type of gossip, like the Sunday talk show gossip, that sort of nonsense. The United States is unique. Very few people really understand history these days. One of the difficulties in discussing this kind of subject, because the dynamics of history are not things that people know, especially educated people. As a matter of fact, the more educated they are, the more they're educated against knowing this sort of thing. They're distracted by other concerns. But the fact is the presidency of the United States is a product of a development in European civilization whose proximate route was the Council of Florence, the mid-15th century Council of Florence. And this conceived the idea of both the modern nation state and modern physical science, both of which are ideas are associated largely with the seminal work of Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa. And despite the mobilization of religious warfare in the attempt to prevent this from succeeding, we had in 1620s, 1630s, we had in North America a acceptance of an idea which had been formulated by Nicholas of Cusa. When Nicholas of Cusa saw what was happening with the fall of Constantinople and the continuing wars in the Balkans, he recognized that the great transformation upward in science and in culture which had occurred in the Council of Florence was now in jeopardy, that things were going to get worse, that old Europe, in its worst sense, was coming back to dominate the younger Europe of that time, modern Europe. And the religious war of 1492 to 1648 in Europe became a characteristic feature of this problem. But in this process, Cusa had, in his writings toward the end of his life, had proposed that we recognize this corruption of Europe, and that we have to look across the oceans to other people and find bonds with other people in other places across the oceans in order to bring about a unification of humanity in the sense of modern nation states united for a common cultural purpose. You had a fellow in 1480, Christopher Columbus, who was a Genoese captain in the Portuguese service. And through a series of coincidences, Columbus in Portugal came across the correspondence of Nicholas of Cusa, and then wrote to Cusa, who by that time had died, and then wrote to leading associates of Cusa for scientific advice. And as a result of this, Columbus adopted a commitment to sail across the Atlantic to find the people on the other side of the Atlantic. And he had a map, which was his guide. He also, being a sailor in the North Atlantic service, knew something about ocean currents and realized that you could foresee that the land area on the other side of the Atlantic would be located in approximately a certain position. And so on the basis of this information, in 1492, he finally got the support to conduct this voyage and opened up the Americas for development of this type. Now, there were several projects of this type. Some came into the Hispanic areas, certain layers of Spain, fleeing from the Inquisition, for example, in Spain, fled into South America in the attempt to found republics in America, which would be extension of Spanish culture, but would be of this type that Cusa was talking about. Then in 1620 to 1630, 1640, you had my ancestors finally arrived on the scene in the Massachusetts area. And they found an idea of a republic, which came through the tradition of Henry VII in England, at the same time, the same kind of thing, which became the birth of the idea of a culture, a nation, built in North America, in which the idea of New England was the first established with this conception. Now, in this process, with the rise of this corruption represented by Paolo Sarpi and the aftermath of the Council of Trent, Europe became more and more hopeless, even after 1648, even after the end of this religious warfare period. And so Europe tended to degenerate. There was a brief Renaissance period under in post-1648 under Cardinal Mazarin and Jean-Baptiste Colbert, which Leibniz was a part. But nonetheless, the Louis XIV, this crowd were corrupt and became tools of an Anglo-Dutch liberal, actually Sarpian conspiracy, and began to degenerate. So we had it founded, therefore, in that latter part of that 16th, 17th century, you had in the United States the development of the idea of a republic, which is to bring the greatest contributions of European culture into North America in order to rescue a European civilization which was degenerating in Europe and was proposed, seemed to be determined to continue to degenerate. So we in the United States, though based around an English-speaking culture, we have roots, common roots, with the English culture in general, as we find from time to time, as in the case of Shelley and Keats, for example. But we are free in our tendency in this country, apart from Wall Street and similar kinds of things. We are free of the corruption, the oligarchical corruption, which is still characteristic of European culture today. And we represent, therefore, because we, to the degree we are willing to play that destiny out, to be the leading representative of the accomplishments of European civilization within the Americas, and to reach out around the world to establish what the Council of Florence had intended to accomplish with its great reform. To that degree, we represent something special. We are not an extension of the British and so forth and so on. But because we were weak in numbers relative to the British Empire from 1673 on, or 1763 on, we have been in a constant war with the British, because the British became at that point an empire in the worst sense of the term. And we were the point of resistance to that empire. But we found in ourselves, as centered especially in the British East India Company, as in centered in New York City finance, around traders like Aaron Burr, we found ourselves also dominated by a foreign influence among us, which is centered in London and the Anglo-Dutch liberal population. Thus today, we represent, those of us who share this tradition, who adopt it and share it, we represent a sacred trust for all humanity, continued from the proposition of Cusa, to reach out around the world, to make ties with people of other cultures, to form a union of sovereign nation states on this planet, which shall be the only power controlling this planet, is a community of respectively sovereign nation states, of which we ourselves must be an example. Thus, when we look at the presidency of the United States, we're not talking about a head of state. We're not talking about one of these things. We're talking about something much more profound, much more sacred, that we represent through our institution. We represent the embodiment of something which is necessary for the sake of all humanity. So therefore, when we elect the president, if he's not a bum like the most recent one, or worse, or Andrew Jackson, another pig, contrary to some favor, he's a bad Democrat. You know, he had bad banks, they had bad Democrats too. That we represent something sacred. So this institution of our presidency, which is our system, it's not the parliament plus the executive, no. The presidency is our government, not the Congress. The Congress is an appendage. It's a control mechanism which determines the character of our presidency, our presidential system. But what's our presidential system? What's the presidency? It's an individual, but that's not the presidency. It's an individual entrusted with a post in the presidency. But how does this individual function in that post? It functions on the basis of all kinds of people and advice, institutions, institutions of government, institutions of outside of government, or people like me as individuals who come to play a part in respect to the policies of our government. And we form a community. That doesn't mean we always agree with each other, by no means. But we form a community as a process, as the presidency of the United States. This presidency of the United States is a living institution in its own right. It's not the presidency of this guy or that guy. It's an institution of this, our nation. It's the characteristic institution of our nation. And it is most immediately represented by those who have experience and trust and who are voices within the community of people, former officials, others, and so forth, who shape the thinking of the presidency as an institution. Now we come to another case. We have an individual, Barack Obama, president-elect. They don't shoot him between now and Tuesday. And the presidency with Barack Obama has now come into existence. It's now a presidency. It's not Barack's as president. It's the presidency under Barack Obama as president. And all of the factors in the presidency converge as a deliberative process to try to steer this nation through for the realization of the purpose of its having come into being in the first place. And therefore, my concern is that Barack Obama recognized the institution, the character of the institution which has been bestowed upon him, and respond to this institution in the terms that I've just described. It's not his decision. It's not his reaction. It's his responsibility to be an agent in that office for what must be done by that office and what we do to help make that. I don't know if he'll make the right decision, the initial decisions on Tuesday. I have no idea. He may not have had the experience. He may not have gotten the judgment. He may not have gotten the seasoning, which yet shows him what his mission has to be. He may make a great number of mistakes, but that's important, but that's not the issue. The issue is the presidency of the United States going to function with him as president, as it should? And pray that he will.
I know that all of you who are listening join me in thanking Lynn for his input, not only today, but over the course of the last months in particular. And I know that his input will continue to be critical as we find our way through this crisis. So ends today's historic broadcast, and I assume that we will see all of you again next week, 1 p.m., January 22nd, for the next in this series of historic interventions. Thank you.